This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Hi, everyone. Just taking you all in. I'm really pleased to be here. It means a lot for me to be able to be in this space and to speak next to Nenzen and to speak to everyone. My name is David Kalili. I'm a therapist. I was also raised in the Bay Area. And I work a lot around couples and sex therapy, but also work with men and people of all genders. And so today I wanted to talk about some of the work that I've done here, the retreats that I've held here, the men's retreats and the future other retreats, but also what I've seen in being able to access vulnerability, being able to work with shame and anxiety that comes up for all of us. And then think about like a practical thing that we can all do in order to try to open up a little bit more. So the reason why I'm doing this type of work is, like I said, I was born in San Francisco. My father was from Iran and my mother was from Austria. My dad was Muslim, my mom is Catholic. Despite the intercultural, interreligious, interracial differences, I noticed that there was this one of the themes was around gendered expectations, both for boys and girls. And what I saw with the boys and for myself in my life was we were restricted to a small box of emotions that we could express. And I noticed with even in myself that I had a hard time accessing my own emotions, accessing my physical sensations. Years ago, I was at a party and a friend of mine said, "My eyeballs are cold." And it astounded me that she could recognize that her eyeballs were cold. I had no idea that you could even notice that a part of your body like that was cold, just as an example. You know, bell hooks is a wonderful philosopher, rest in peace. She talked about the concept of soul murder. And in her book, The Will to Change, which is a really wonderful book on masculinity and love, I recommend it for everyone. If you've ever interacted with a man, it could be a good book to read. And she talks about how boys are the first victims of patriarchy. Everyone is the ultimate victims of patriarchy, but boys are. And the reason why she says that is because they are given the small box of emotions that they can be, they can express themselves through. And over time, through direct and indirect messaging, policing, harassment, abuse, encouragement, or welcoming, you start to learn what is acceptable and what is unacceptable, what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. And you start to learn what's gonna bring you into the community, bring you into the other guys, bring you in for love and hugs from your parents, and what's gonna make you pushed away and banished. And over time, we develop a script or a knowledge or an understanding of ourselves of how we can act in the world that will allow us to be loved and will allow us to be accepted. And we start to act out that script and we start to act out that way of being. And again, it's not this character sheet that we're given and then we say, okay, I'm just gonna follow these roles. It's something that we learn over time and it also becomes something that's hard to unlearn because of that process. When I was thinking about this talk, I was reminded of an event in my life when I was 12. An older relative passed away suddenly. He had an aneurysm and died. And his, just at the memorial service, at the funeral, at all the gatherings to mourn him on my Persian side, I recognized that his adult daughter was given a lot of space to emotionally express, to really grieve, to cry loudly, to yell, to scream, to throw things, even throw herself into his grave. But I also remember the moment that her brother came to town and walked into the house, and he was a wreck because he just lost his father and he wasn't in town. And I saw the look in his eye of just despair and sadness and grief, and he was just as expressive as his sister was. And immediately all of my male relatives surrounded him and pushed him outside. And I remember my 12-year-old self in my ill-fitting suit looking out the door and seeing this hurricane of an image where he's the eye of the storm and the rest of them are circling around him, just literally like almost like whirling dervishes circling around, trying to contain his energy and his grief and his torment, his suffering, just in the service of being able to be still and stoic and physically present for his sister and the others. And then I saw him walk back into the house, and he was there, he was physically there, but I could see in his eyes that it was just this thousand-yard stare, and he wasn't emotionally there. And he felt like he had to be that for his older sister. And I've also seen the other side of it, where people are able to really sit with their grief, sit with their suffering, sit with these, for some, terrifying emotions, these terrifying experiences, and then work through them and not have it carry on them, and find ways to soothe or to avoid or to get away from. And, you know, one way that I think about that is being able to access your emotions is also being able to be vulnerable. And that's a thing that's been talked about quite a bit over the years. But like, what does that actually mean? And what does that actually look like? And it's a conversation I have a lot with some of the folks in my practice, the therapists that I work with, the men that I work with. And, you know, I find that vulnerability can be seen as a boogeyman for people of all genders, but with the men that I've worked with, it's almost like this reaction of, nope, not going to do it. I'm not going to be vulnerable. That's not a good thing. That's not going to get me where I want to be. I will see them like tense up and get really big and say, like, you're saying that this is a good thing for me. I should be vulnerable. I should. And I'm not saying it's 100%, I'm not saying it's all or nothing. I'm saying that there's moments where vulnerability is good for you, and there's moments where vulnerability will harm you. But to help us think for you, or to help you think for yourself, when you can show up in a vulnerable way, and what feels appropriate to you, what feels appropriate to the situation, what feels appropriate to the other person. But again, there becomes this thing where it's seen as this anti-masculine trait to be vulnerable. And what is masculinity is another big question that can be its own long multi-day talk. But also masculinity, just as a little side tangential thought, masculinity, as bell hooks talks about, it's hard to gain and easy to lose. So it becomes this thing that becomes this kind of this game that you're playing in your life in order to stay in and stay accepted. And so if men are trying to avoid vulnerability because it's uncomfortable, you know, I see it as they're, in a way, they're avoiding vulnerability to avoid suffering. But if things like endurance, grit, powering through that kind of suffering is seen as a positive masculine trait, then why shouldn't vulnerability be seen as a positive masculine trait as well? I think there's a lot of strength in vulnerability, knowing that what your capacity is, what your desires are, what your needs are, what your boundaries are, regardless of your gender. And so how to be vulnerable, the how to do it, you know, it's talking about shame for the last 15 or 20 years, just recently recognized that working with shame is a lot like making pasta. And this might sound weird, but it's simple in its steps, but it's really difficult in its application because you have to have a lot of patience, you have to have a lot of practice, and you have to really kind of use multiple parts of yourself. You can't just be using your logical mind. You have to also be sitting with the substance. And so with vulnerability, you know, it's not something that you just want to throw at someone. This is also about consent and about permission. You want to ask the people in your life, can I open up to you? Can I share something with you? So I think about it in terms of thinking of a topic that you hold some vulnerability, some shame around, and thinking about a person in your life that you feel you trust enough that they're not going to judge you. And then you're going to find a time and a place that feels appropriate to ask them if it's okay to open up to them about this thing that you've been carrying. Maybe you're going on a hike. Maybe you are making dinner with them, whatever it may be. And you just say, you know, I've been holding on to this thing for a little while and it's really been bothering me. I feel like I might be blowing it out of proportion, whatever preamble you want to use, but you're essentially saying, can I open up to you a little bit about this worry that I have, this part of me that feels shameful? And if they say yes, you let them know. And then you sit there and you observe them and you observe yourself. I think when some of us are trying to open up for the first time about something that we feel vulnerable about, shameful about, we may quickly project, we may quickly jump in to their, to expect their reactions as a form of protection. If you like reality shows, Love is Blind, season one has a great episode where he opens up as bisexual and didn't even give the other girl a chance to have a reaction. He just said, I knew it, you were going to judge me. And it just kind of ruined the whole thing. And so, we've got to talk about reality shows sometimes. And so you sit there and observe, and you notice what yourself is going through. What are you expecting? How they're going to react? How do you expect that they're going to push you away or welcome you in? Or a less active way of doing this is allowing space for humane relational moments. I have had a lot of, you know, in my short time with Jokoji and with Nenzen, I've had a lot of wonderful experiences, and one of them kind of transpired over the 3 weeks of, you know, it was before the retreat and then right after the retreat that I just had here. And I have a 3-year-old son, and my mom really enjoys spending time with him, of course. And I was listening to Peace's Every Step on a drive over here. And Thich Nhat Hanh was saying that older folks, I'm paraphrasing horribly, older folks like to sit with young children, not just because of their energy, but because their skin is nice and warm, and older folks' skin is cold. And that sat with me for a little bit. And then I had this wonderful retreat experience here, and the Sunday Dharma talk, Chuck Hutchcraft talked about dependent origination, where we come from many points and we go to many points and we're connected in many ways. And I sat with that and I thought about that. And then I saw a week later, on a trip with my family, I saw my mom with my son, and she said, I like holding your hand because it's warm and soft, and my hand is cold and dry. And just each moment, my heart started to crack open a little bit. And then later that day, I was playing with my son and just throwing him up in the air and spinning him around like a plate. And an older guy in his 70s or 80s started to walk by us. And I saw him kind of looking at us while we're playing. And I'm trying to figure out, what is he going to say? Is he going to say anything? Is he going to. And then a big smile came on his face. And he said, you know, I got to tell you something. When you get to my age, you'd pay $1 million to be his age and playing with your dad. And tears started coming down my eyes, and tears started coming down his eyes. And I said, I think I know what you mean because I'm not there yet. But, and he said, yeah. And I said, thank you, have a good day. And he said, thank you. And he kept moving, and I kept moving. And it was just this really beautiful 2-second experience. Like, I still get nice little chills that, you know, that happened because I allowed myself to be open to receive these scaffolded moments. And because this random guy came up and said that wonderful thing, he could have said, you're going to break your kid's head open. He could have said, you know, it's too hot to do that, whatever it might have been. But no, he had this really nice, humane moment. So thank you all for sitting with me, thinking with me. I want to open it up. I have some questions for you all, but also if anyone has questions, I'm really curious, like what comes up for you all, whether it's a physical thing or a narrative, point of narrative, or like a message that you have that makes it difficult for you to express emotions. And we can make it more specific, like express emotions in relationships, or we can just keep it open like that.
I have a question. I'm not sure it's right on that topic, but you know, given that men have issues with expressing vulnerability and emotional openness, and they're say they're with a partner, and how would the partner, how would the woman, or maybe it's a man, but a woman or man, how would the partner or a close friend skillfully and appropriately encourage them to you know, be more open or more available or more vulnerable?
Yeah.
How would the, you know, someone from the outside encourage someone who's a little held back?
Held back. No, that's a great question. Yeah, I think about like patience and curiosity, asking questions, not trying to problem solve, which, you know, stereotypically tends to be what the guy tries to do. Validating quite a bit. You know, I think sometimes we can immediately go to dismiss or minimize because we don't want to sit with that emotion. A lot of guys I talk to say that they have a hard time opening up because they feel like when they have opened up, their partner, their parent, their friend didn't know what to do with that. And that's real. They've also told me on their end, you know, my friend opened up to me about, you know, a relationship ending or a death, and I just froze. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. I think the best way that we can encourage that is to just ask more reflective questions. The person trying to get the other person to open up, asking more reflective questions, how does it feel, what's going on for you, not trying to jump to any conclusions or a therapist friend.
Or judgments.
A therapist friend also calls it don't bingo them, which means don't say, aha, that's why you're like this. Don't bingo them. Don't say, bingo, you're... Yeah, I've got to figure it out for you. You're kind of thinking together with them. And also, you know, giving lots of encouragement to those who are socialized as men to continue pushing that discomfort for yourselves and not waiting for the door to be opened. Not that you're saying you're doing that, but for the others that are listening, to really push themselves to try to be vulnerable and work against these messages that they've received.
Hi, Alex.
Hi.
So I'll tell you, from my perspective, a barrier to opening up is the fear of being judged.
Mm.
And also the fear of not knowing what the response will be from somebody else, because we all talk different languages of vulnerability.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be, at least in this society, this country, a common universal way of expressing it and receiving it either.
Mm-hmm.
I know that what helps with me is when I'm sharing vulnerabilities is when I know the other person's not going to be reactionary,
yeah,
or judgmental, or even often or offer a fix or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's worked for me. Question about Buddhism and vulnerability. How do you see those interacting and intersecting? And how I absolutely see how mindfulness can help with anxiety, fears, anger issues, because keeping it in the moment now,
right,
not in the past, not in the future, is really helpful for that. But especially when dealing with others, with vulnerability and emotions and things like that, how does Buddhism play into that?
I hope someone would ask this, because I knew that by inviting David to speak, that would be a question. Yeah. I didn't prepare an answer, unfortunately, but I have one, or some thoughts around this, which is that the Buddha taught us to know the causes and conditions of your suffering. Know the causes, yours, right? Which are everybody's. They don't just belong to you, of course. If you know the causes and conditions of your suffering, you are opening to your own vulnerability, yes? You're recognizing yourself. In that wall, in these mirrors, in this mirror, It's a vulnerable act. It's a courageous and vulnerable act to sit down and face yourself, to admit all the things you don't want to admit, and to allow all the stuff you want to allow, too. Some of us have trouble with the good stuff, too. So it's a vulnerable act to face your own causes and conditions. And in my experience, and I think many people's experience, at least those of us who practice a lot, would say that as you get more and more comfortable admitting to yourself your own vulnerabilities, you have compassion. And it arises quite naturally. You don't have to go try to get it. It arises here for the one who is admitting the whole beautiful catastrophe, some teacher called it. And then for everybody else, because they are all just, they are you, and you are them. So, you know, David said earlier on that vulnerability, there is a strength. It's courage, and it's big, and it's powerful, and it's liberating. And that's our practice.
Did you say by liberating, it builds confidence? Is that where you're getting the liberation from, is self-confidence?
I would say trust.
Trust.
Trust in your own experience. Examined, affectionate, not examined like a... but examined with an open heart, with the awareness of vulnerability. And also, I really appreciate your comment about the uncertainty of opening up. Maybe I would like to ask that of you, David, that there's this tremendous field of uncertainty when you're going to talk to anybody about the real authentic you. There's this vast field of uncertainty right in front of you, right? You don't know how they're going to respond. And you're not in charge of their response either, but you're in charge of how you respond to their response. And I would like to ask you a little bit about how to navigate this territory of, okay, I love this person, I'm going to share this, and they may have a response that is really not about this sharing. It's about their own projections and needs or discomfort with what I'm sharing, and how to navigate that.
Trust came to mind as well when you were talking about the uncertainty of how they're going to react. You know, we can't predict how they're going to react, but we can predict to the best of our abilities how we're going to show up in those moments. And through self-discovery and self-understanding, you know, my little approach is understanding your attachment styles and understanding your trauma reactions. And we don't have one fixed attachment style, and we don't have one fixed trauma response. We kind of fluctuate between the spectrum, on the spectrum, but it can be really useful to know how you're going to show up in those moments. And so if this person that I'm opening up to responds in a fighting way where they're trying to get me to, you know, they're dismissing me and putting me down, how do I normally respond in those situations? Do I freeze up? Do I fight back? How do I want to show up in those moments? So having trust in your own understanding and awareness of yourself, your own insecurities, your own idiosyncrasies, your own nervous system, accepting that your nervous system is a big, chaotic, powerful, systemized force, all of the above, and it's going to work with you and against you. And in those moments when you're being really vulnerable and taking a risk, your nervous system is going to be sending lots of alarms, trying to protect you. And so finding ways to understand that and work through it, not just in mindfulness of being present, but also in just knowing who you are and how you show up.
And those of you who heard that, knowing yourself, that's our practice quite a bit. Who is that self in that moment? Because we know it's not one self that you're stuck on. So that is a good question to raise, you know, in any given moment. Who is the self who's responding?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a question. So many, like, they have the traditional norm that they have to be tough and strong. So I wonder, how would they overcome the norm? How should they start with it?
I would say, you know, just recognizing moments where they aren't on that realm and being able to accept that, you know, being able to accept the strengths that they have already that aren't the strong and powerful things. And then even breaking that down, what is strong and powerful? And what does that look like? And why does that have to be so gendered? I know way more women that are strong and powerful than men. But, you know, allowing space to work against the times where that immediate message comes in and says, don't do that. And it's often it's not conscious and says, because you're a guy, but you're trying to break down that other narrative of why can't I do that? And so you're slowing down and, you know, maybe the example is they want to give their friend a hug, but their friend is, you know, maybe resistant to it, or they feel like that's not allowed in their culture or because of them being a guy. Finding the circumstances and the situations where that can be acceptable, where they can at least practice it out, would be something that could be useful. Talking around it, talking to others about why it is they have difficulty trying to do those things. That way it's almost like giving it a test ride before actually trying it on for size.
I think this is in relation to the men opening up and sharing. I've had a lot of guy friends in the past talk about relationship experiences where they feel that it actually hurt them to share their emotions and vulnerability with their partner, because they said they felt like after they kind of did that the woman was kind of like lost interest in the guy, or didn't see the guy the same way, like, oh, he's not a strong guy, I'm not attracted to him anymore. So a lot of guys have talked about how they don't want to do that again.
Right, it feels like a big risk. Yeah, I mean, and that's such a big question, because, you know, in my mind, those are also people that are following a narrative or script, and maybe they do want that. Maybe that is something that they want. And if that is the case, then being in a situation where their attraction or their connection is that quickly lost, you know, it's the bell hooks piece is hard to gain, easy to lose. It's also about finding the person to open up to about that, and based on what you know around, you know, about them, what they've shared with you, is this going to be a safe person to open up to? And that there are risks in opening up in this way, and that there's going to be some loss, that maybe this is just the point I'm at in my life, but it can sound a little callous, but I get to the point where I'm like, okay, well, maybe that's not the person that I want to be interacting with in my life. And it can be callous, but it also feels very protective of my time and space and energy and what I'm giving out there. And just like Nenzen was saying, it's okay, that's their shit. Sorry.
Did I say that?
You didn't say that.
You can get away with that.
Okay, that's their stuff, you know. And then recognizing that they did take a step in being vulnerable, and if it felt good for them, regardless of what the other person's response was.
I guess with the idea of it being hardened or stiff, a man maybe protected, and then finding a soft space or a tenderness and the opening or the sharing to make it more vulnerable. And if that's been repressed, I can imagine a floodgate of emotion that would overwhelm someone.
Yeah.
And so almost self-fulfilling prophecy, if you do it only every once in a while, then you're going to harm the person that who's might try to help, or they might run away.
Mm-hmm.
And almost more of a sense of, can I regularly go back in there and get a chance to share? And almost, I really appreciate having a space like this that's getting centered. And as I'm sharing, noticing, is this too much? Am I hurt, or is not that this might be a beginner and someone who's listening? Mm-hmm. If I shared with an 8-year-old, they would say, all right, that's foolish, but someone could be 40 years old and still kind of like an 8-year-old when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. And I guess the language around that of almost helping someone, I like the recommendations, you know, I'm not looking for you to judge or to give me a solution. Can you just hold this space? I don't know, as far as creating the container, can you speak to that? Of what makes it easier And then the mindfulness of noticing, boy, I'm sharing, and this is too much or maybe too little, or sensing within ourselves if we're off balance there in a way.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the consent and permission piece is one part of the container. The little knock on the door saying, I've got this thing that I'm just chewing on. Can I talk to you about it a little bit? Because I've been that partner. I've been the other partner. I've worked with these couples where they just open up the door and go, you will not believe my day. It was so horrible. Or I'm just so worried about our financial situation or whatever. And it's just this dump. And it feels like, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is what a relationship is. We're supposed to be vulnerable. You know, I think there's also a cultural component where in some cultures, there's a boundary difference between cultures, right? Within Western cultures, there's this individualistic style that we keep everything to ourselves. And in Persian culture, Iranian culture, you know, there's very much a collectivistic style of we're sharing everything together, we're taking care of each other, but we're also representative of one another. And so there becomes this way where we have to be restrictive of how we show up because we can ripple out to other people, but that's a tangent. Mm-hmm. So you're setting the container by asking permission, asking for consent, saying like, do you have the capacity to hear me out? Is this something that you want to hear? And then checking in with yourself and then noticing that it is practice, that you're not going to get it right the first time. I'm thinking of dads that I work with where I'm just trying to get them to talk to their teenagers a bit more. And they'll come back to me and they'll say, well, I tried it. I said, how was your day? He said it was fine. And then he just didn't say anything else. And I don't know what to do anymore. And I just walked away. And I'm like, great, you did it. Try again. Because we have these protective parts of us that say, you tried it. It hurt. It was shameful. Whatever it may be, never do it again because you don't want to feel that.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, and that's a wonderful example, the father, the teenager, that I think there's a sensation that it's going to overwhelm at both sides.
Yeah.
That I won't be able to handle it at both sides. You know, that the teenager is going to go, bleh, all that teenage stuff that the father may or may not have resolved his own.
Mm-hmm.
And or that the father just doesn't yet have the, as you said, kind of the practice or the muscle to be able to hold it.
Yeah.
So that feeling of overwhelm. And I notice as this gender that I often think, especially when I was younger, I'm just too much.
Mm.
It's just too much. Too much. It's mm-hmm. too much. So I would just shut it down.
Yep.
So I think there's that little piece in there about either fearing it's going to be overwhelming or feeling it's overwhelming coming from the other direction.
Yeah. It just makes you think about how all the policing that others do to us and we do to ourselves, depending on our various identities or social context.
So at what age do we stop being like just friends with our friends and without any assessments? When does that curtain come down and we make these judgments? And I will say that in practice, you kind of return to the young person
mm-hmm.
and you stop feeling like David is me. Mm-hmm. Why would I think anything about him? If he can feel it, I feel it. If I feel it, he can feel it. Like, where do you experts think that?
I think it's
divides us.
Yeah, around
divides us.
Right. I'm starting to see it a little bit in my 3-year-old.
Yeah.
the separation where, I mean, it's a healthy individuation differentiation, but I've heard it's around 5 or 6. You know, like 3, 4, 5, or 6 is around when they start to become, okay, this is, you're over there, I'm over here. Mm-hmm. The categorizing starts to happen. And then the categorizing become, depending on where you're at or how you make sense of it, can be really calcified, mm-hmm. and which then creates more, you know.
Separation. You have someone online, Tim. He's got his hand up.
Oh.
Tim Song, can you unmute? There you go.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, thanks for the talk. My mind's sort of spinning. I'm trying to think, you know, being vulnerable, Yeah, it would put me at risk. You know, for a long time, I feel like I'd get caught in between people, that kind of vulnerability. And so practice has helped me to become, connect, be able to connect and be more compassionate or intimate with other people. But I still have this difficulty with being intimate with myself, you know, being self-compassionate. And I wonder what kind of aspects of your practice that can foster that self-compassion, that kind of vulnerability.
For me, what's coming to mind is, in therapy speak, is the inner critic that shows up when we're trying to sit with ourselves and when we're trying to do new things or things that are important to us. And I think of the inner critic almost like a, not just one person, but there's an inner Greek chorus. It's just an amalgamation of all of the people and experiences in your life that you've had that have told you what to do or not do and why. And again, this becomes this script or this rule book that we follow. And so being able to know when that inner critic is showing up and what they sound like. Some practices talk about naming the inner critic, making it silly, making it sound like Kermit the Frog, just to kind of get some distance and take some power away from it. But yeah, noticing that the inner critic is part of you, but it isn't all of you. And you know, try to find the other ways through that. It sounds really vague on that last part, but the big part is acknowledging the inner critic. And the inner critic is really connected to the outer critic. They're toxic cousins. So the more you're judging others around you in your life, the more you're going to judge yourself.
Is that like confirmation bias?
Yeah.
Tim, what comes up for me is this kindness that you show. I know you. This warm, open-hearted kindness and compassion that you generously provide to in every encounter. And so when that voice comes up that is not skillfully speaking to Tim, I think it's fair to say, would you speak to Nenzen like this, or Sokyo like this, or your sons or your wife? And you would not. And to just, you know, kind of affectionately say, okay, that's enough of that. And let's be kind to ourselves, because your capacity for kindness is vast. I know this already, and you know it. So just kind of allow it for yourself. And the capacity for it then increases for everyone else. So if you have to, if you have to create a narrative where you're doing it for everybody else, that's fine. But do it for yourself, too.
Right. Yeah, I can be more curious about it myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Sangha has really helped me to do that in ways I couldn't do myself. Thanks.
Thank you for your question.
Yeah, I have a question. I don't know whether you have children, especially boys.
Yeah.
I have two boys. So yeah, and as a father or mother, so do you have any sharing good example to show the example for children that they can be vulnerable, and the vulnerable is the power, not the bad thing.
Yeah. A big thing for me is just the labeling of emotions. You know, of course you're upset because I turned off the TV, or, you know, it makes sense that, you know, you want more crackers, but we're not gonna, but still holding your boundaries. So you're labeling what they're going through, but you're still carrying on your rules, your boundaries, as much as a three-year-old can listen to rules and boundaries. Notice when you are trying to manage their emotions, and why are you trying to manage them? Where is that coming from? This is not a gendered piece, but a body image piece for me. I've had a relationship, weird relationship with food all my life and with my body. And when my kid was 6 months old, he was devouring a delicious bowl of some mush. And he was just pouring it into his mouth. And I had this immediate reaction of, do not do that. We don't eat like that in this house. And it was, and like, I laughed to myself as well, because I was like, that is really silly that I'm about to chastise my 6-month-old who barely understands anything, or let alone his nervous system, about the etiquette of how we should show up and, you know, show our bodies and show our food and relationship to food. And so kind of tracking that sort of influences as to how we're trying to, I say police, but, you know, also like raise our kids. You know, my son is a very expressive, very warm, chaotic being. And I sometimes wonder, like, okay, at what point is the, you know, the social structure is gonna be kind of collapsing him or putting him down? The other day he told me when I was leaving for work, but I don't want to miss you, Daddy. And so he's going to be a lyricist in the future, is what I've decided. Yeah. But I remember my nephew saying, he learned in baseball, you know, boys don't cry. And so sitting with him and working against that narrative. Sorry for all my tangents, but critical race theory was a big jump. But critical race theory talks about one way to work against racism that is all around us and will always be, is through storytelling and anti-storytelling. And so recognizing the stories that you can create in yourself, whether it be about gender, about race, about culture, about religion, and also working against the stories that are out in existence, trying to push people down this path that you don't want them down, we don't want them down.
I have two adult sons, and I'm just, yeah, I have enough perspective now.
I'm so curious.
Maybe the only thing I did right, I mean, I tried very hard. I was really a dedicated parent. But I think the only thing they have told me, now it was the only thing, but they told me I did this right. And that was, I taught them, really starting young, that we had this thing called open mic. You know what an open mic is? I never have been to an open mic in my whole life, actually. But it's when people, I think in bars, get the mic and can do whatever they want, I guess. So, but an open mic where they would say, I need an open mic. And they were little, and they did it all through college, high school, college. I think we probably still do it. Where they get to sit down, I have to listen. I'm not allowed to speak. And they get to say everything that they're, I mean, it doesn't matter with the words, it doesn't matter if I'm reacting inside. They get an open mic. And I take it, like, with not reacting. And sometimes I would say, do you want me to mirror that? Which means I then have to express it in my own words, which was often torture. but I would do it, and they would say, no, you didn't get this, and you didn't get that. And I would say, okay, let me try again. And I would try again. And my adult son, who's a psychiatrist, 31 now, says that changed his life. Mm-hmm. That's why he's able to listen. Thank goodness I did that, because it helped me, too. It helps everybody when we listen. So, but that's not an easy thing to do, because we're parents. We're really invested in that DNA.
Yeah.
That beautiful 3-year-old DNA. So that's the only advice I can give anybody, is that listen and give them the freedom to speak their truth, which it's not easy for us.
It does such powerful wiring.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, thanks for like all the story sharing. So I do really want to share something, and also one short question. So I'm actually not a typical, because I was actually came from a really traditional Asian family. So basically, I'm actually not a traditional Asian guy. Because basically, for me, I'm actually super sensitive. So basically, when I was really young, I have tons of emotion in my world. But most of the time, my parents, they don't really understand why you have so much emotion. Because I do really have a big sister, because sometimes I just feel like even I have more emotion, more emotional than my sister. So basically, I've been struggling for such a long time, because basically there's no space, there's no room for me to to talk, and also it's better for my sister, and also even for my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And also something really happened is after I've been doing some like therapies like in the such a long time, like four or five years. Something I know is actually it's okay, it's totally fine to be vulnerable, to show your vulnerability, but you actually need to find a relatively stable environment. And also you actually need to find someone who can actually give this kind of like a vulnerability to you. So basically I might some kind of like close friends and all, even my therapist later. So basically it can actually give me a really solid anchor. And also they can actually really appreciate this kind of like emotional intelligence. So basically they know what you're actually doing, and also they can actually try their best to give you a response, even if that is not something that you're actually asking for. So yeah, that's basically something I actually have a really like a strong relationship where I actually share your personal journey. So I really appreciate that. I heard the story here. I didn't actually expect like I can hear this kind of like a personal story from you. So my question is actually, so basically when sometimes we actually hang out or even trying to build up a connection with your partner, but something really common for my past experience is actually they may actually don't have enough like this kind of emotional intelligence for the vulnerability part. And also sometimes they're actually not open to the therapy session or even marriage or even group session. So, but they was trying to know you, they was trying to understand what is going on. So do you actually have any suggestion for this kind of situation?
Yeah, so your the partner's emotional intelligence or access is at a different level than you're at, and you're wanting to open up a bit more. Yeah, I think a big piece of that, as best as you can, is to try to understand where they're at and to accept that level of emotional access and intelligence, and then try to kind of meet them where they're at and then move up from there. Again, easier said than done, but just also working on noticing your own frustration of, gosh, I really want to open up more, but they're just not able to take it. You know, sometimes people can't handle long lengths of time with a discussion, you know, they kind of, while their partner really loves the 3-hour deep dive discussion and they only got like 20 minutes in them. And so try to find that compromise. Okay, maybe we're just going to do the 20 minute chunks so that you can be present and be there. Yeah, I think that's the other piece is it about vulnerability and emotional access, or are there other things in their life that's going on? Maybe there's some neurodivergence, there's ADHD, and so trying to understand what they need in order to sit still enough. Or maybe it's going for a walk. Maybe it's just a really bad time in their life right now where they just got laid off and they're stressing out. But I'm also hearing you talk about this pattern. So I think it's, you know, finding a compromise in the pacing and the depth that works for both of you, finding different situations. You know, the face-to-face may not be so easy for some people, so going on a hike with them or something like that could be a little bit better. And then, you know, there are one-day workshops, or maybe try to find a movie that hints at some aspects, and then that leads to a conversation. Yeah.
If you have more questions, you know where to find him, right? It's on the website. And David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for being here today with us. And this.
Thank you.
Thank all of you for your willingness to be open and present with vulnerable making conversation about vulnerability. So,
bottom of page 2.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.